There are ear poets and eye poets and mind poets. There are also some touchy-feely poets, but we don't need to talk about them tonight. Jane Owain's new book of poetry, From the Night Album, proves that, although she has an ear for a lyrical line and she has a keen and curious intellect, she is, above all, a poet who both sees and helps us to see. The first stanza of the title poem, From the Night Album, begins, "A woman steps out of a family album, and room by room, she walks through a large house, turning off the lights." Here, Jane Owain does what she does best. In three simple, elegant lines, we see someone step out of a book, out of her book, or out of the past. The images resonate literally and figuratively, open to possibilities. The poet turns off the lights so we can see better. In the next stanza, quote, "When the last light dims, she climbs out of a window and regards the house from her own death," end quote. And we see that Jane Owain looks on the world not as a cold-eyed journalist, though she has an unforgiving eye for detail, but as someone who has more than a love-hate relationship with the world. She can stare unflinchingly at death, even her own, without losing the ability to gaze wondrously at the world around us, the world of things, kitchen tables and desks, beaches and houses, books and photographs, but also the unique world of her imagination. As poet Gerald Stern writes, "By following her own inexorable path, I want to say her literal path, she succeeds in discovering another world, perhaps the other world, for us." Pecan Grove Press released From the Night Album last month. Jane Owain is also the author of two previous collections of poetry, A Strange Heart, which received the Devins Award, and Looking Both Ways, which received the Marianne Moore Poetry Prize and Society of Midland Authors Poetry Award. Her poems have recently appeared in such literary journals as Poetry, Iowa Review, The American Scholar, Plowshares, and, of course, River Styx, among many others. Please welcome once again to this podium, Jane Owain.
Thank you. Woo, I'm not so tall. I don't know, is this working?
Yeah.
Don't know if I can stand here though, like this. All right, how's that? Okay. Well, tonight I'll jump around my new book. That's my granddaughter. One word and she's out. Sorry, guys. Bye, sweetie. She's two.
It sounded like a yay.
Yeah. Good way to break the ice. The poem I'll start with is called In an Old Desk. And I think it shows my continuing interest in interiors, furniture, houses, gardens, and I think of myself very much as a domestic poet. I love being at home. I write at home. In an old desk, open the top drawer of this desk, and you're on the threshold of a musty house. A lone pencil rolls along the corridor, and nothing buffers it. Then the bottom drawer drags like a trunk lugged across a wooden floor. Inside, a few faded snapshots have despaired of finding albums. They're either creased or curling at the edges, and leaf brittle to the touch. Right under them, where a rubber band crumbled, some letters drift out like sheep through a hole in a fence. But no one rounds them up. A flock of envelopes with canceled stamps, faded ink on faded stationery. Here, when I pry off a paperclip embedded in a page, it leaves a rusty kiss. You've been gone long enough for glue to harden in the bottle. Nothing stays the same, except the climate in the closed drawer. always overcast, and snowing dust on love letters. I guess that sort of shows how I think all the things around me kind of speak. And I guess in the same vein, I'll read a poem called On Wide-Lined Paper, which starts from a memory of just one object, but then kind of unfolds with a little bit of looking at. On wide-lined paper. Again, the drowsy clouds through sky-high windows, and the room that boxed us in, the banner of alphabet wrapped around its walls, desks lined up like numbers in a column, and the fresh sheet of paper that started the day, name and date, top right, hand tensed around a yellow pencil, then in drawn-out silences between each spelling word, the first answers that spilled onto the page, pell-mell as a toss of jacks, were followed by a panic of erasers, a vacillation that rubbed the letters into streak and scratch until the guesses we handed in were ghost-layered palimpsests, all our faults etched in the soft paper's stone memory. Well, childhood's an inspiration. This one's called Matinee. It has an epigraph from the Brothers Grimm. Bring me back her lung and liver as a token. Brothers Grimm, and that's for children. In the forest of that movie theater, where I peeked out not through trees but fingers, and my legs dangled from the leather seat, even if my feet didn't touch the ground where Snow White scurried, I held my breath between the lightning and the thunder. And when the queen snarled in the castle, green and yellow flesh dripping down her cheeks like candle wax, I was mesmerized, backed into my chair until that taloned finger pointed at the magic glass. Then jumping to the ground, I turned, stumbled past a row of legs like tree stumps. Such cackling at my back, the whole time I was breathless. The aisle itself, oppressive as a hill, and how far the door, the small red embers of the exit sign. I knew before I got outside, the slap of daylight wouldn't bring me to. Wherever I'd go, there'd be no mirror safe from her, no kingdom that she didn't rule. Over the din of traffic, cars, pedestrians, I could hear a croaking in the distance, some blackbird that can tear the flesh from bone. For a change of mood here, I guess for me, well, nothing is ordinary. The ordinary is often extraordinary. On a clothesline between two pines, summer, in the cool of early morning, a faded version of the moon still in the sky, then just the drift wood gray clothespins and the white of the towel forgotten on the line, the night's damp still in it, and not much else, except that somehow we'd crossed over, opened our eyes, or splashed our faces at the sink, that there were stones to touch and thoughts we couldn't, and now unfolding chairs, canvas snapping into place, wooden legs settling into sand under us, that all of this could happen, that it could stop, not just dreams, but sleep itself, rain mist, evaporation. I have all these markers in here, and they don't mean anything. Except that I'm a disorderly person trying desperately to seek order. Visits. Here's more domestic imagery. Visits. In a burst, as when you lift a lid from boiling water, he comes back. A penciled note tucked inside a book, or a jar of salvaged varnish crusted over like a scab. The house is mined. A plate breaks. A kitchen chair teeters on hind legs. Even breadcrumbs careless on a stick of butter can explode. You've happened onto gloves buried under papers or on the bottom of a drawer, a roll of film that's been exposed. That's all it takes. A room can give off sparks the way a burning log does. Bright visits that you're never ready for. When you tear a rag in two, it's not shredding you here, but a dust cloth reverting to a shirt. The next poem I'll read arose out of a conversation. And I'm always interested in that. You know, people always assume that the poem is about your life and that there's nothing constructed, you know, that it's not fiction. This arose out of a conversation I had, and it just, you know, it took off. And then when the person who inspired the conversation, when his wife read it, she looked at me like, what? You'll see why. Blind spots. First it was Vermeer, the lemon yellow of the woman's dress against the apron's vibrant blue. And on everything in the scullery, the painted light I'd almost missed. Then the conversation turned to vision, how you had to train your eyes on your desk to see a certain glow between the study window and the carpet. And I thought of mirrors, some self there that's fugitive, not the eye to eye, but the sidelong, the off guard a camera catches. And that other childhood game played against our boredom, long summer afternoons when we'd repeat a word to empty it of meaning, word, 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 spun out till we grew lightheaded, the same dizziness close to one another now, your face dissolving into separate features, the walls gone flimsy, then a few steps back to let the painting reassemble where it hangs, stranger back to lover. You know, writing one poem at a time, I'm not conscious of the things that sort of cluster. If I look at the book as a whole, images, I see that I do often snapshots, photographs, paintings, movies, that these things come up. And in this one, there's a drawing. Interstices, again, like the need for breath, it sweeps over them. Then a kiss, that close, a full embrace. And in the space between them that has their shape, a certain darkness where the bodies meet, not from night, but the shadows cast on one another. Arms, legs, a Turk's head knot of limbs, and still some line of demarcation comes between the two of them. Even flesh on flesh, it's there, some boundary, dark, indelible, some bold brushstroke keeping them apart like lovers drawn in ink that we step back to watch. I guess this next poem has the opposite pull. I'm reminded, I think it was Yehuda Amichai that was at UMSL, UMSL, that is, and that said, you know, you could write a poem that said, marry a girl from your hometown, or one that said, never marry a girl from your own town. And so, you know, you could take either side of an argument. The fundamental forces. Astonishing, the tug, not just dust to corners or moon-driven tides, but the sway on everything, the push and pull that one can't argue with. A gate sags, a can of paint explodes. So much occurs in spite of us. Even in the shower, the water whirling down the drain pulls at us. It's suction on the foot like an oppressive kiss. And doesn't yearning itself demonstrate the law of gravity, the constant pull of one body on another? We meet, we cross a room, moved like iron filings in a magnetic field. The curtain billows in the dark, a loose spring rattles in the bed. The force that holds together particles holds us. The small returns. You used to smile at how lightly our Japanese house guest entered a room and pulled a door into its frame without a sound, as if the plaster walls and the wood were shoji screens. How much we learn from entrances, my Russian slams, our daughter's detonations. And what about your signature? A certain trudge, a solidness, some low note played on a cello. I never told you how day after day the back steps groan or the whine and shudder of the screen door could take my breath away. A knob, a latch, the thinnest metal click, and I'd stop like a hunted animal listening for a twig to break till you called out and something in the woods retreated. We need one of those hooks that they used in vaudeville, so I'll know where to stop. I don't wear a watch. This won't go on forever. All right. This poem sort of operates on that idea that I find very consoling, if there's anything consoling about the death of a loved one. But it's that idea, it's in prose letters or some other prose of Rilke's, the idea that where else but in death could the loved one be closer, that is, in our hearts. The neglected. Just now, I stumbled upon that room where she was sitting on the same sofa, not dead after all. But something had changed. Was it the drawn shades that spoke of reluctance? The light, the green of algae in a fishbowl? I couldn't catch her eyes, her face, the blur that takes flight from a branch before binoculars can steady. And the whole time, only a hint of words, her wavery voice moving in and out of range like music on a radio. Then a sudden sinking where I stood, a soft carpet maybe, losing ground in any case, no argument, no arm strong enough to bring her back across the border of awakening. So loss again, this time mixed with knowing I'd visited before and come home empty-handed, that what emerges in the dark, the tired woman on the tired sofa, the tired room itself, has been there all along, not just friend, neighbor, intimate, but all my dead relegated to some attic of the mind, all my ghosts waiting on hangers to be worn. The cover of the book, which you cannot see from where you are, but I'll tell you, it has a globe and a chair, which are... I instantly looked at this painting by my husband, Shelley Helfman, and thought, oh, that would make a great book cover, because it has surreal touches, and there are a few surreal things in here, but only after a friend sort of was looking at the work. Oh, I can say it was Alison Funk. She pointed out how there are a lot of domestic things, but also I go out, I do write. They're not travel poems, but they're based in other places, awakenings in other places. So I'll read you one of those, just to give life to the cover. Near Bellecombe. Nothing of interest, we were told before we set out in the heat. And still, as if we expected more after browsing those few streets, we circled the aisles of the church and cemetery. Then was it the houses, shuttered for the afternoon, the red geraniums left out in pots, or the door closed on the only restaurant that made us stop outside the dirty windows of that storefront? To peer in, we had to climb onto a stone ledge and press our faces to the glass. When we gripped the wooden panels, the weathered paint was rough as bark. Boards gone back to trees, I thought. Were we too late? Inside, the gloom held shelves where we could make out bolts of fabric in a jumble, like crayons stuffed into a half-empty box. And near the wall, a sewing machine without a lid, its metal torso draped in cobwebs. Chairs, tables, floors, everything was cloaked in dust. So much left behind, but nothing to take away. No clues, no answers, unless one could count that chair, the kind we sit on in the house we're visiting, a slight ladder back with rush-woven seat, toppled over near the wall. Hands cupped around my eyes, I tried to picture it, blinkered out the day to bring the darkness into focus. Did they leave slowly? Some movement toward the door you'd hardly notice? The progress of a needle along a seam? Or was it abrupt? One of those spools leaping from a lap, its thread unwound along the floor. All right, I'm going to end with the title poem. Before I do that, I'm going to sneak in a new poem. Notes taken in the dark. Might as well be beetles, labeled, pinned to a board. Or even violets pressed in a book, that flat and desiccated, most of the color gone. The bird, too, that hovered over the locust trees, only a shadow left on the page, blurred, featureless, a face in the mirror you don't recognize. Call it weakness, the midnight ink drying a paler blue, the open windows letting out the secrets until the drowsy scrawl belongs to no one. And of course, you didn't resist, couldn't really. Too rickety, the bridge between the night and day. You can't get back. Notice the wind already erasing your path. A whisper, some rumor started at the back of a classroom years ago, while slowly, a city, another place you only visit once, sinks into the sand. So by afternoon, at low tide in the marsh, all meaning has washed away. From the Night Album. A woman steps out of a family album, and room by room, she walks through a large house, turning off the lights. When the last light dims, she climbs out of a window and regards the house from her own death. Of course, it's only a dream, so the scene can change to a desk where a man who knows her secrets is putting them in order. Here, there are no walls to keep the woman from drifting to a beach. Here, too, she can watch both the man in the room and the tide obsessing over the sand, as if the next wave could get it right. And he goes on, the man at the desk, arranging a child's set of blocks inscribed with cryptograms. Now, only a hand appears on a book, and though she is invisible, she knows she's older. Then the pages start flipping back to front, and she is racing to keep up. Her heart gets faster, the pages smaller. In all of this, no one says a word. Thank you.